This next question, I'm trying to make sure that if there are similar questions, we can do them together. But this next question is, have you discussed an alternative burial route with the Plymouth Board of Selectmen or any other town official to avoid digging up and disrupting businesses along Route 3, Main Street in Plymouth? And if so, what did you discuss?
So I can't speak specifically to Plymouth, but for municipalities across the entire route, we've been having ongoing conversations with virtually all of them at some level, including exploration of alternative routes that might be preferable to a town.
How could somebody find out if you've actually spoken to Plymouth?
So I was going to turn it over to the team as to Plymouth in particular. Do we? I'm sorry?
Yeah, there is a representative of the design team that has been had meetings or preliminary meetings with the town of Plymouth. Those meetings will continue, and we will work with the town to come up with a solution that works for everyone.
Can you give the questioner an idea of what was discussed?
I honestly don't know. I apologize.
Okay. Next question is similar. Has a resident on DWH Route 3 proposed underground line will be disruptive to residents and business? I think it's, will the proposed line be disruptive to residents and businesses along this route? And also, why can't all the lines be buried underground?
So as to disruption, you know, when we move beyond siting into construction and the planning around it, one of the things we do routinely, and it certainly would be the case here, is to work with the municipalities and the local businesses to minimize disruption. May look at, you know, which season would be least disruptive, what time of day would be least disruptive, are there construction methodologies that would minimize, in particular, business impacts. That's something we do in the ordinary course, and we would certainly do it here. I'll just turn it over to the team. Is there anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, just from a residential perspective, while construction will be happening in front of your driveway, you will always have access to your driveway. We'll work with you individually to get you in and out, either by putting a steel plate over the trench if it happens to be open, so that you will always have access to your property. Similar to, as Bill mentioned, we will work with businesses to try to provide access to driveways and to maintain business operations at all times.
And as to the second question, you know, I think it asked the question of an all underground route. We have certainly looked at that option. It adds approximately $1 billion to the total project cost. And from our perspective, it makes the project uneconomic. And we've been trying to...
Please let him finish answering his question. Please be courteous.
Yeah, so we've been working towards a balance, a project that addresses the principal view impacts, works technically, and also is economically feasible. We think we've got the right project. An all-underground project is uneconomic.
Okay, the next question is, what percentage of the infrastructure will be underground?
It's approximately one-third, so it's 60 miles of a 192-mile route, so a little less than a third.
Why can't the hydroelectric line that runs from Quebec through the western part of New Hampshire be shared with this project?
Yeah, so that is an existing supply, and there's actually a second interconnection with Hydro-Quebec that runs through Vermont. Those projects have been in service, similar to Northern Pass, for decades. They're both all overhead construction lines. They are, in essence, at capacity. What Northern Pass does is it brings in a new source, a new supply, to replace basically power plants that have retired or are retiring, many of them right on our doorstep, like Vermont Yankee. And if you look to Massachusetts, Pilgrim Nuclear Station, they're retiring. A lot of the coal generation fleet has retired, as has oil. So we need a new supply. The two existing lines simply don't have the capacity to make a difference.
Right, but I guess the question, though, asks why you can't share that.
Share the right of way.
Yes.
Okay, different question. Okay, I thought you were referring, just put more through the existing line. Go ahead, Sam.
So we actually did look at that corridor as a potential route for this project. The right-of-way that's existing today is at its full capacity, meaning that there is no more room to put other structures in there if we'd done some designs. And we also looked at potentially expanding that right-of-way. And there are too many areas where there are easements or conservation easements that abut that right-of-way, so it is not fully expandable.
And I will just remind you, you know, the currently proposed project, not only is a third of it going to be underground, but the vast majority of the balance is in an existing right-of-way running parallel to an existing transmission line. So it's in some respects comparable to running it in parallel to that existing interconnection with Hydro-Quebec.
Yeah, there's also Jim Muntz, President Transmission. There's also some basic design criteria that we need to comply with to make sure that we all have, you know, safe, reliable, and as secure as we can make the power system in today's day and age. If we were to find the room and squeeze the lines in on that existing right-of-way, you'd end up with one right-of-way where if you lost it, the regional electric system could not support that without incredible upgrades that would make any project along that right-of-way, you know, infeasible. So, you know, that's a sort of a basic design criteria that the North American Electric Reliability Council and FERC promulgate and require us to adhere to. And ISO New England, lets us know about that. And, you know, that's a basic concern that kind of ruled out that right away, right at the start.
And the last question from this question was actually their first question, but because we were dealing with underground, I didn't ask it, but I'll ask it now. How much of the power will actually come back to Grafton County?
So all of the power will be delivered to Deerfield, New Hampshire. There was mention earlier about a power purchase agreement. We intend to, at some point, have a power purchase agreement with Hydro-Quebec that will reserve 10% of all of that power for New Hampshire customers. You know, 10% is a little bit greater than our percentage of the load of all of New England, so we've gotten at least our fair share. The balance of the power flowing over the line has not been contracted for, so it could well be available to New Hampshire if there's a need, but we will at least have 10%, and all of it will be physically delivered to Deerfield, New Hampshire.
Next question. Well, the first question this questioner asks is about Concord. The Concord City Council, its subcommittee, 20 emails and 664 petition signatures oppose the project and is requesting its burial through Concord. If Northern Pass is truly listening, will the line be buried through Concord?
And we are listening. You know, I think I mentioned some of the changes we've already made to the project design as originally planned. Substantial commitment of additional underground construction. That has added several hundred million dollars to the project cost. Also required us to reduce the size of the project, so the benefits to New Hampshire and New England and customers in these regions have gone down as a result of it. But that was, in essence, based upon feedback we had gotten from New Hampshire. We are certainly aware of questions that Concord has about the existing plan. We're going to intend to continue to work with Concord just as we are with every other municipality in ensuring that we address their concerns.
Today, do you plan to bury the line through Concord?
That's not our plan today, no.
Second question, why did Northern Pass choose Route 116, Route 112, and Route 3 to bury 52 additional miles instead of Route 93? Route 93 is 8 to 10 miles shorter, as well as having no impact to homeowners and businesses.
Yeah, so we have recently filed with the Department of Energy a very detailed explanation as to why Interstate 93 is not a feasible alternative. In our view, it simply doesn't work. So when we made the commitment to avoid the White Mountain National Forest, Franconia Notch, and the Appalachian Trail, we had to look at these secondary roads. That's what led to the selection of the three roads you mentioned.
As owners of property on both sides of 116, when and if are we going to be contacted to address our specific concerns as they relate to our properties, as well as those of our neighbors and, I can't read the word, but in general, those of our neighbors and I guess as families in general? I would like specific and exact information, not generalized propaganda.
Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to Sam Johnson in a moment, but one of the things we've been doing for years now is working with property owners up and down the route. We've had, I believe, over 3,000 contacts at this point, generally to answer questions and to provide information. Sam Johnson from Burns and McDonald, his team is overseeing that. So can you talk specifically about this portion?
So a couple steps have to happen. As we go forward, we're going to refine our design to get a more specific route, which side of the road it's going to be on, which properties it will be near. As we go through the construction planning phases, we will then work out our schedules and when we expect to be in towns. We expect a trenching operation to be in front of somebody's house for somewhere between 1 to 2 weeks. That will depend on soil conditions, amount of rock that's encountered underground, and all of those things still need to be determined and finalized. Once they are, we will basically start a end-to-end outreach program to meet with every single abutter on the project and to discuss in detail how the construction will then be propagated. Also, we'll meet with towns to do the same thing.
I will say, you don't have to wait until that process, okay? If you're an abutting landowner and you have questions today, either get in touch with Sam tonight or any of the other project team members, and they'll be certain that you are contacted immediately. This is something that's been ongoing, as I say, for many months, and has been, you know, quite extensive in its reach. This is the formal process, but we're willing to meet with any adjoining landowner at any time.
Next question is, where else in the United States are there any other HVDC lines buried under the same winter conditions that Northern New Hampshire, quote, enjoys, close quote? Meaning snow, ice storms, spring flooding, et cetera.
Perhaps Sam or Jim, can you?
There are none to my knowledge. The fact that this is 60 miles of underground is unprecedented in North America.
Next question. Okay, there is an existing right-of-way in Stark which has a buried gas pipeline and wooden power poles which are shorter than the trees, and we cannot see them. Question number one, are there regulations within this right-of-way pertaining to the heights of the power poles? And number two, the gas line is buried without anywhere near the Northern Pass Towers opposition. Do you know why the gas company can afford to bury their pipeline and Northern Pass claims that it costs too much? So the first question is, are there regulations within the right-of-way pertaining to heights of power poles?
So there are design regulations, which is the National Electric Safety Code, that determine the minimum clearance to ground that must have happen, and that's for electrical safety, so you know, it's a standard design. The other factor here is that the height of the structures is determined potentially by the width of the right-of-way, meaning that if we are constrained in that particular right-of-way, the towers would have to be more taller rather than shorter. To further answer the question, there are also codes that describe design that has to be done in the neighborhood of high pressure gas pipelines, and the way that construction techniques are used in that area. So that is all very defined and very safe. It is my understanding that except for in the Alaska area, where the pipeline is above ground due to tundra, and some of the other places in northern Canada, that all gas pipelines are buried underground in the U.S. And Canada, for the most part, for safety reasons as well, and security.
And the second part of the question was, do you know why the gas company can afford to bury their pipelines, but Northern Pass says it costs too much?
Unfortunately, I'm not. I don't know. They understand fully the economics of the gas pipelines. Obviously,
go ahead. Yeah, the gas pipelines don't have a choice except to be buried.
Okay. The next question is, Northern Pass, you say that complete burial would cost $1 billion more than the cost of the project has proposed. You said that this is based on an average of $7.5 million per mile in addition to the cost of overhead construction. Can you provide more details about the assumptions that support this estimate? And the questioner has three specific assumptions that he's asking about. Did you assume burial of the line along transportation corridors? If so, which corridors? Did you assume that the additional cost includes costs of cable? And if so, does buried cable cost more than above ground cable? And number three, if cable cost is higher, how much and why? And I'll get to number four. I've probably given you too much on your plate right there. But the first question is, can you provide details about the assumptions that support the estimate of $7.5 million per mile?
And let me just answer that question just at the outset. That number is based upon our experience with underground transmission construction and cost, as well as the experience of several of the largest contractors in the country who do this for a living. So our kind of estimates and expectations have been verified now that we are in deep discussions with actually the construction groups who would build this. So, and we feel very comfortable with that range. Now, as to the numbers, Sam, do you want to shed some light on that?
Yeah, and I don't know specifically, but I will tell you that overhead conductor is in the neighborhood of tens of dollars per foot, and underground cable itself is in the neighborhood of thousands of dollars. So it's a many orders of magnitude difference. So yes, underground is much more expensive than overhead from just the pure cable perspective. Yeah, Cam.
Just to add a little more detail on that, and it's really based upon the design of the conductor. The insulation has to be sufficient in just an inch and a half to have the same effect of several feet in open air. So again, it's a constraint, and the insulation has to be to much higher quality than just open air.
Okay, so that's answered the third question. If cable cost is higher, how much and why? But the first question was, in your estimate, did you assume that burial of the line would be along transportation corridors, and if so, which ones?
Yeah, so we have assumed it's going to be along the public highway. If we were talking about burying it in a transmission corridor along a right-of-way, that $1 billion in incremental costs would be much, much higher. Okay, and I know there's been some confusion about earlier statements years ago. That was looking at the cost of burying it in the right-of-way. As you would probably surmise, blasting your way through an existing right-of-way, including the White Mountain National Forest, is going to be far more costly than burying it along the public highway. So this estimate is based upon burial along the public highway. It's approximately 130 miles of additional undergrounding. We looked at several different alternatives, but it's pretty simple math. It's approximately 130 miles. It's on the order of $5 to $10 million per mile. The incremental cost of using the public highway is approximately $1 billion.
Next question is it more expensive to bury the AC lines between Franklin and Deerfield than DC cables being used between Pittsburgh and Franklin? And if so, what is the approximate difference per mile?
So AC cable has three conductors, where DC cable only has two conductors. So incrementally, it's about a third more expensive. Also, the trench has to be wider and deeper to get the AC in, because it has the three full conductors. It's my recollection that the project in Connecticut that did install the AC conductors was in the range of $18 million per mile.
Next one is, you would have to have been at the meeting last night to understand this question, but I'll read it. Last night, two project engineers answered the question about whether they'd want their grandchildren to live next to the overhead DC line or the buried DC cable. They both said overhead line. Specifically, why is a buried cable less desirable for that grandchild or for other people?
I was one of the engineers that spoke of that last night for four reasons: construction, operations, the economics of it, and the environmental impacts of it. I'll go into each one in more detail. The construction is much more difficult along public roads, even versus a right-of-way, and that increases the cost of it, but it also increases the complications of digging through the road. There'll be construction impacts to that, to residents and to businesses versus constructing on a right-of-way. In addition, in this case, there are a number of river crossings and large road crossings as well. That complicates the construction a great deal and the length of time to do that. The second area that I spoke of was around the operation of it. While underground systems are very reliable, in fact, in many cases, they experience less frequent interruptions than overhead circuits do. When they do occur, it takes a long time to make the repair. Could be several weeks for an underground cable versus hours or days for an overhead system. The third area is around the environment. We maintain several tens of thousands of acres today on transmission rights of way. That creates a habitat for certain species that otherwise would have a very difficult time surviving and propagating in the future. So there is an environmental impact, a positive one, for transmission rights of way and the clearing of those areas, especially for birds. And the last item is economics. We have to have an economic solution for the energy needs we have in the future. And specifically, we have to have a greener source of power in the future. So there is a long-term impact to delivering clean energy into the region.
Okay. Last night, your two project engineers indicated that a project like this involving burying miles of 1090 cable in residential and rural neighborhoods has never been done before. Therefore, how can you be sure that this will be safe? For example, people whose houses sit 15 feet from the buried cable. And actually, while you're talking about that cable, the next question is, what is the maximum temperature that the cable itself can reach once fully operational?
The maximum temperature is somewhere in the 45 to 55 degrees Celsius range. It is surrounded by insulating material, not only in the cable itself, but also with a thermal sand that helps to dissipate the heat underground.
What was the first part? First part is how can you be sure that it will be safe, for example, for people who live 15 feet from the buried cable?
A little less than 10% of our system today, transmission system, is underground and is operated for decades very safely. The only places we've had issues with the underground is when an external party has dug into that. In that case, the protective systems on those cables operate instantaneously and disconnect the power at both ends, rendering it safe. So those are the only cases of problems that I've ever seen on underground transmission systems.
Next question is, what chemicals are in the heat dispersing under the road fill?
It's sand. That's it. Just sand.
Did you say sand?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Since this has not been done before, how do you know that the additional underground heat and chemicals will not cause towns and people's older water pipes in the rights of way to leach lead into our water? Will you pay for lead testing before construction, after, and once the power is running? And then the questioner also says the water pipes will be very close to the cable. So basically the question is about how do you know it won't leach, that chemicals will not leach into towns and people's older water pipes.
Right, so the answer again is there are no chemicals that will surround the cables themselves. The design of the cables will take into account all underground utilities. So if you have water pipes that go back and forth across the roadway that we may be impacting, we will go around them, or we'll work with the landowners to move those pipes such that they can coexist together. As far as lead testing, traditionally we do not do lead testing. However, we will work with people, individuals, on a case-by-case basis to ascertain whether or not that's required.
Next question is for the SEC. It's got two parts. First one is, what does the intervener's requirement of orderly and prompt conduct not being impaired? I think there's a word missing. I think it means, what does that mean? What it means is you have to demonstrate in order to get intervener status that you will not impair the orderly and prompt operation of the proceedings. In other words, you won't delay it for unreasonable purposes. You won't do frivolous things. You won't, you obey the rules and regulations of how the adjudicative process is to run. You won't interfere with other people when they're asking their questions of witnesses. Things like that. And basically, that's half of what the chairman of the committee will consider when determining whether or not somebody is entitled to be an intervener in the case. The other half is you have to demonstrate that you have a substantial right or interest in the outcome of the proceeding. The second part of this question is, if RSA 162H requires full and complete public disclosure, why is the essential business financial benefits analysis being allowed to be confidential? I forget the specific name. It's an English company. I don't think it's an English company. I think what you're discussing is Appendix 43, which is the London Economics Report. I think London is somebody's last name. But that motion has not been ruled on by the Site Evaluation Committee yet. The applicant has filed the motion to for protective treatment of that particular exhibit. There is other exhibits that deal with the business and financial benefits and impacts and benefits contained in the testimony that has been submitted so far. Along with the application, there was written testimony from an expert. But just to be clear, that motion has not been granted by the committee yet. So ultimately, the chairman will rule initially, at least, on that motion and take into account the criteria under RSA 91A and determine whether or not the reasons put forth by the applicant are sufficient for that document to be treated confidentially. And then the next question is back to the applicant. Sure.
On the intervention question, I think it's an interesting question, and the standard as elucidated by Mike sounds harder than it really is. And for anybody who's interested in intervening, I suggest that you simply write a letter explaining your issues and the reasons why you think you ought to be intervening as clearly and succinctly as you can, and submit that. There's no particular format or formality to it, although if you go to the docket, you'll see that there are people who have already filed intervention petitions in sort of a formal way that looks like a pleading, and you can copy that and put your own information and facts in it. I encourage people to do it because it's the way to give the most weight to your views when they're presented to the committee. The committee we'll see that you're very serious about it, that you put in testimony, that you participated on a regular basis, and that counts a lot. So I would recommend that you do that.
And Peter's right. There's no magic to a motion to intervene, and I didn't mean to make it sound like it was particularly hard, but the question asks about what does it mean, so I've tried to explain that. You can write a letter or an email. As long as you put in it why you believe you have a substantial interest in the outcome of the proceeding and that you will not impair the orderly and prompt conduct of the proceeding, and your motion will be considered by the chairman.
And with respect to the confidential documents, typically in these cases, I get access to confidential documents. There's occasionally a document where it's kept secret even from me. But generally, I get all of this stuff and I look at it fairly carefully. And the experts that I retain, they will also get it and look at it carefully. We will be looking at the present motion that's on file to see if
it warrants our response to it in a more considered way than we've done so far.